Well, it's hard to believe it's many months ago that first Roman Kabanak hit the international, not just the South African headlines, but international headlines, when he was summarily dismissed and refused to go as the consultant chief of staff to the Minister of Agriculture, John Steenhuisen, who just became a minister. It's a heck of a story there, but we're going to find out more what Roman learned there, what it tells us about politics, and what we the people should be thinking about what's happening in government and indeed this new era of an ANC at 40%. And it's Roman, not Roman. I guess most people who've never listened to you, or listened to your podcast, and you've been prodigious in what you've produced over many years. When we look at your name, where does it come from? Where does Roman or Roman come from?
Well, it was the reason why I was dismissed. I was born in France, so I'm a dual citizen. So I'm a French citizen. I speak French at home. My parents are French. And in French, you say Roman. But in South Africa and in the English-speaking world, they say Roman. Or I prefer Roman. But I mean, either way really works. I'm not fussy at all.
Have you kept, I mean, this isn't the purpose of this conversation, but have you kept many of the French traditions? And I think specifically about the way the French bring up their kids, which I admire hugely. And I think anybody who studied it would know that it's almost like there's a very different way that the French approach rearing of children.
Yes, they all drink wine and they all smoke cigarettes. It's tradition in my house. So, I mean, they did serve red wine at schools in France until 1956. And when that decision was terminated, I think the world became a much poorer place.
Well, I have very dear French friends who live in Normandy, so I have been exposed to that a little bit. But this is about you, and it's about your experiences over the past little while. Now, I've watched the podcasts that you've done, or the conversations that you've done on Morning Shot and with Ronaldo Goos in the last couple of days. This after you were finally fired on your birthday. And I'm sure everybody knows that story by now. It's been all over the place. But what I haven't got out of there is your past and your, I won't say addiction, but your exposure to politics. Because I first came across you through my dear friend, Kanthan Pillay, when the two of you started the Purple Cow, the Capitalist Party of South Africa, which many members of the BizNews community actually voted for. I think of your 30,000 votes, or however many you got, you probably got a big chunk of that in was it the 2019 election that came from the BizNews community, because we aligned with your way of thinking. But what got you into doing that in the first place? Because starting a new political party is never easy.
Well, it was our dear friend Compton's idea. I thought it was a ridiculous idea at the time. But, you know, when Compton says, let's do something, you just say yes. You don't question anything about your motivations. Politics has always interested me. As someone once said many years ago that you don't care about politics, but politics really cares about you. And I think that if you really do understand politics, you're able to actually live your life in accordance with things that you cannot control. So a small example is I bought a new house a year ago. We are completely off grid. Not because of I hate the state, but because I know I'm looking at the politics of our country. I'm looking at the politics of Eskom. I'm looking at the politics of unions. And I know for a fact that we probably will still have load shedding, and the water infrastructure in Johannesburg, where I live, is not going to survive much longer. So knowing about the politics has made my life easier, because I've taken steps to get away from it in that particular regard. And then as for the sort of theoretical side of politics, I like to read history. I like to read about the French Revolution, the Roman Empire, and all these things are lessons for us today, because history is actually cyclical. Human beings don't actually learn anything from the past. They just try to repeat the same things under different contexts and with different technologies. But at the end of the day, we still are human beings, and I don't think that we change that much over time. So it's always good to know where we come from, and to see what lessons can be learned from the past, but also, more importantly, if we do repeat it, how do we get out of it in a net positive way?
very fascinating about the way that history rhymes, as Mark Twain said it, because in the world that I come from, in investments, it's a similar thing. We have Mr. Market, who is the manic depressive who hasn't got any medication, who one day thinks that a company is worth 100 and the next day thinks it's worth 50. And that's just human nature. That's the way it works. So politics the same. But when you left, when you guys didn't get into parliament with the capitalist party, looking back now with so many other little parties that have started, was it a mistake to abandon the idea?
No, I don't think it was a mistake. I think we would have been crowded out. A fundamental issue we faced was funding. We didn't get the funding that was promised when we registered the party. And now it's just insurmountable. I spoke to Dr. Franz Cronier a while ago, and he estimates that a new political party to get 10% of the vote will need at least R1 billion to get started properly. 500 million rand for the setup and the branding and all that, and then 500 million rand just for the year-long campaign before the election. There's maybe a few hundred, maybe 1,000 people in South Africa who can actually give that as a charitable contribution to politics. And those people are not going to be funding startups. They're going to be funding the existing structures, the existing political parties. So by and large, I think, yeah, politics is going to be entrenched in terms of how the elites fund it. And I don't think there's any appetite in South Africa, at least, to fund alternatives to what already exists. The GNU, as far as I can tell from newspaper articles, is basically a collaboration of political and financial elites in this country. And that's what they wanted, and that's what they got. And that's why it's going to sustain itself as long as it is funded correctly. The alternatives won't get anywhere.
It's a sad situation if you think about it, because most of humanity looks at politics as in an idealistic frame of mind. And I wonder whether you did that when you went into the belly of the beast in the first place. But maybe just to go back to finish your story or get your story to when you went into the position with John Steenhuisen. And so the Capitalist Party of South Africa didn't work out. You then joined my field in a way. You became a podcaster or a journalist, but expressing opinions, the Renegade Report and then Morning Shot. And I've had it told me by a former journalist who is now quite senior in politics that journalism is the gateway drug to politics. Did that play in the same way in your mind?
In some ways. So we started the Renegade Report podcast back in 2015 around the Roads Must Fall scenario. And looking at newspapers and looking at social media, everyone was just so enthralled with this idea. And I just found it horrible. This idea that you can desecrate statues or try to remove history from where you are, or, you know, God forbid, burn paintings, burn art. Like, I just thought this was inherently a terrible idea. And we started the Renegade Report, and the first episode, in fact, was about Roads Must Fall and the idea that this is not something we should be accepting at all. That put us on the map. We weren't trying to be provocative. Myself and my co-host at the time, Jonathan Witt, we were just speaking our true minds about the ideas percolating in South Africa at the time. And of course, once you have a podcast, you want to speak to guests. So you bring on guest after guest after guest, week after week after week. And that's when all the new ideas get infused into your mind. So, I mean, the network effect is massive if you have a platform. And I learned so much from speaking to so many people. It's the first time I met Helen Ziller. It's the first time I met Jordan Peterson. It's the first time I met Moletsi Mbeki at the time. Once you have a platform and people come on, that's how you learn. And of course, most podcasts in South Africa tend to turn towards the political because there's not much else going around in terms of the economy or things like that. So inherently, you go towards politicians to come to your podcast. And I suppose once you speak to many of them, you actually get infused with the ideas of politics and you understand it as something that is vitally important and something that South Africans actually do care deeply about. So in a way, I knew about history before, but the podcast really opened my mind to brand new political ideas, especially locally.
It's so interesting because the evolution of BizNews has been very similar to what you were talking about. We were initially, from our own background, which was all about business and investments, but then we realized somewhere along the path that in a developing country, politics trumps economics every time. So you better find out what's going on in the political environment, because without it, you just don't have you won't have an economy. And I think that's been part of our journey of focusing on the political economy. But from your perspective, so the next big step, I guess, and I regret I did not start off by saying that you're well educated. You actually educated as a lawyer. Where did that all happen?
So after school, my father in particular forced me to get a degree. He offered to pay for it as well. I wasn't interested. I disliked school immensely. So with my mark to matric, I couldn't get into engineering or medicine or science, and I didn't want to do a Bachelor of Arts. So the only thing left was really an LLB, a law degree, which I did obtain from WITS. I worked in the legal field for close to 15 years, along with other things. I get bored easily, so I do like to spread my wings and do as many things as possible. I never qualified as an attorney, so to speak. I didn't finish my articles. I did a year of them and refused to be employed until my stint as chief of staff. And that's essentially why it happened. It's not a field I particularly love, but it was quite useful during its time.
So you never served as an advocate, even though you do have an LLB. I had a partner, I suppose he was, Barry Sargent, the late Barry Sargent, a wonderful, wonderful human being who did LLB, but never did his articles. Well, I don't know, maybe he did, I can't remember, but he certainly came into journalism very quickly because he felt that it was the most honorable profession. Do you share that judgment?
I don't find what I do particularly honorable. I just enjoy it. I don't see myself as a messiah or a doyen of the truth or anything like that. I just like putting ideas into the world. I like talking to interesting people, and I take the opportunities when they arrive, as this one as chief of staff did. I was approached to become chief of staff, and I jumped into it without hesitation, because with the political realignment of South Africa, it's easy to sit on the outside and as I did, critique it. But when the opportunity is there to actually get into the so-called belly of the beast and try and make a difference, I think you have to take it. There's almost a moral obligation. You can't just be a critic your whole life. It gets a bit stale, and your mindset is a reactionary mindset. So it's much better to have a building mindset, and if the opportunity is given, to actually join the thing that you critique the most.
Teddy Roosevelt, the man in the arena. You were moving from critic to actually the bloodied arena, and my goodness, did you get bloodied. But did you know John Steenhuisen well? And I mean, this is not a loaded question, but it's a very serious question, because there are different views on Steenhuisen. Did you know him well before you accepted his request to join him in this adventure?
So I wouldn't say I knew him well, but we were more than just acquaintances. So I had the opportunity to speak to him through the various podcasts and shows about three times in a decade. I think we had lunch once in 2020. And then we had and then he invited me for dinner just after the election last year on Inauguration Day. And that was the first official dinner I ever had with him. So we were casual acquaintances, not close friends by any means. I haven't been to his house. He hasn't come to my house, but friendly acquaintances, I would say.
And you had clearly had a very good feeling towards him. Had he been reliable in all the engagements with you up to that point?
In terms of if I invited him for a show, he would come on. But I never sort of, I'm not one to badger people. So if I had a question and it wasn't answered on WhatsApp, I'm perfectly fine with that. I understand people are very busy. But we had a good friendly relationship. But as I said, I saw him maybe once every 2 years, or maybe once a year over the past 6-7 years. It's not someone that I would invite to my children's baptism or family occasions, because it was more professional. Maybe there's a case in journalism where you have a relationship with the people that you report on, but not necessarily friends. so to speak. I'm sure that exists. So I would classify it as that sort of relationship.
And it is important because what happened next was, well, the reason for you going through the fire over most of the past year. You get appointed, off you go to China with Steenhuisen. You get to see things that few people are exposed to. You do a pretty good job there. Certainly the feedback that we get on in South Africa on from the agriculture department is good. You're the chief of staff, so you're kind of making it happen. And then you arrive home and your world changes. Now, just take us through what happened then.
So I think it's important for just to start that I never was a DA member. I never voted. I voted for the DA once when I was 18. I was never part of the structures of the DA. I was never paid by the DA for anything. I had a friendly relationship with some people in the DA, some in leadership and some at a more local level. So
why?
Why?
Why were you never a DA member?
I was never invited, to be honest, and I never thought of joining the DA.
Yeah, you never get invited to a political party, but
sure.
But it's quite important because you now go and hitch your trailer, as it were, to the leader of the DA. So in the back of your mind, you must have been thinking, hang on, if I get close to Steenhuisen and if I do go into this, I've now had the great gateway drug into politics. If I get involved there, maybe this will be a fast track into really making changes in South Africa. Did that occur to you in your thinking?
Well, I mean, when he asked me to join, and I was headhunted, I didn't apply or anything like that. Like, he asked me to join out of the blue, I might add, really out of the blue. And for that, I'll always be grateful. Like, to be asked to be a chief of staff to a minister, especially the leader of a political party, is a great honor. And it's something that I'll always cherish. But I was there to serve the minister. He happened to be the DA leader, but I was there to serve the minister. My job is to serve the minister and the ministry, and then coordinate the ministry along with everyone in the sector, including the department and other ministries. And that was my job, and that's what I did. I had no intentions of joining the DA. I had no intentions of trying to change the DA. My job was, I was very busy doing my job. So I'm quite good at what the term, compartmentalizing what the job is and what the role is. And I have no intention of so-called playing politics as the chief of staff to the Minister of Agriculture. I'm there to do a job. Agriculture is vitally important. It could soak up so much more labor. We could open up so much more market access around the world. We can really get down and ensure that biosecurity and that the health of animals are perfectly fine, so that we can have much more market access, which brings far more forex back into South Africa, invest far more into agriculture, get so many more jobs. It's about the important industry that has been neglected for a very long time. And my role was, and my goal was, along with the minister, of course, is just to make sure that industry can thrive. And that's it.
A huge potential, huge, huge potential for South African agriculture. You saw that, and this was your way of serving. It's interesting when one goes into the public service. I've worked in the public service for 2.5, 3 years at the SABC. And it's like your mindset changes. You really are there to serve. And I found a lot of the people I worked with were incredibly dedicated. And subsequent to that, seeing people working in the public sector, they get a bad rap often in the media. But a lot of people are there, seriously are there to serve. Did you find that as well?
I had a very good relationship with the department and the staff members of the department. I spoke to the Director General fairly often. I spoke to the Deputy Director Generals fairly often. You could see if some have sort of a political slant to what they wish to do, but they were always open to conversing about it. They were always open to talking about it. I only had professionalism and courtesy from the civil servants in the department, and it really, I actually do miss them. We used to spend quite a bit of time together with a few of them during my time there. And, you know, I think that most of them do a good job. Most of them are thoroughly decent people. Maybe one or few bad apples, as in any other organization, but I wouldn't call these people malevolent in any way whatsoever.
Because there is a perception that the ANC has stuffed the public service with cadres, and that these are all people there just to try and do deals and steal, and they're all corrupt. I mean, that is just the way that it does when you get so much media coverage of it. It's hard to find the balance. Now that you've come out of there and had the experience that you've had, what would your perception of the public sector be, or perception rather of that that kind of narrative?
So my perception will be narrow. So I've only dealt with the Department of Agriculture. I dealt a bit with DIRCO in terms of organizing overseas trips and spending time with them on agendas. I did spend time with a few other people in other ministries for a very limited time, though. And I just found professional people for the most part. I'm not going to say the most efficient, go-for-it type of people around, but if you speak to them, they understood what they had to do. They had the knowledge. They had the expertise. I wouldn't classify these people as caterers at all. These are professional people who are doing their jobs. The problem with the sort of bureaucracy of the state, which is something that is not inherent to South Africa, but really Dominic Cummings, the former advisor to Boris Johnson, once said, the essence of the state is process is more important than goal. And that's what I found a lot, which is a bit frustrating as someone in the private sector where goal is the most important thing, whereas in the bureaucracy of the state, process is very important, often much more than the goal. So I found those sort of things frustrating, but I didn't find the people frustrating at all.
Roman, you looking at the private sector from the eyes of an entrepreneur, if you worked in a corporation, I'm pretty sure you'd have a similar, come to a similar conclusion where the process, the meetings, who you're friends with, the internal politics, it's not that much different from the way that you've described it a moment ago.
I would assume so. I think a lot of problems we face is the sort of complexity of bureaucracy, and it's a problem that we've had for close to 100 years, especially in the West, and I think it actually leads to a lot of dire consequences, politically and otherwise, in many places in the world. I mean, I think, for example, Donald Trump is someone who is the antithesis of that sort of person. Presidents, administrations come and go, but the bureaucracy always stays. And now to try to change that bureaucracy, I mean, even Elon Musk, I don't think he would admit it, but even Elon Musk failed to do it in the time that he had. So if he can't do it, and he's a brilliant man, I'm not too sure who else can.
Yeah, he should have watched Yes Minister, and he would have realized what he was up against, although that's got to do with the British bureaucracy. It's been there for hundreds of years, and it's going to be hard to change the concrete.
A friend of mine, Sir Byron from Morningshot, who was my partner there, actually said, if you want to understand, before you even go into the States, just watch Yes Minister. Everything you need to know is right there. And he's up to you with the drawing.
Well, but you gave it a good shot. You were running at a rate of knots. And then let's get back to the story. You come back from China and suddenly you haven't got a job anymore, or they don't want you in the job anymore, or your boss doesn't want you in the job anymore. So what actually happened there?
So we were in China. My relationship with the minister was developing. We were doing very well. We arrived back on a Saturday, I believe. And during the time that we were away for about 10 days, including travel. I just felt like the media onslaught. Come on. I've seen a lot of silly things in the past. You make content, you make videos every day. You have got tens of thousands of hours of video and audio things out there. Of course, you're going to missay something, or something's going to be taken out of context. And the media really focused on like three tweets that, even to this day, I don't know what the problem with them really is. So I could feel this pressure even while in China for my duties. And on the way back, everything was perfectly fine. I said goodbye to the minister on Saturday. We arrived then. And then on the Monday, I received the email from him at about 11 a.m., which didn't say resign. No one ever formally asked me to resign, but he did say, let's try find a dignified way for you to exit. And to this day, I still actually don't know why he made that decision. He did say, like, this media is distracting from the work that we're going to do and things like that, but there was never ever a definitive explanation for that. I have my theories about it, which I'm hoping to test quite soon. So that was the Monday, the 9th of September. And then we spoke on the phone a bit later. I could see that it felt like he was under duress for that time. And I said, well, let meet and let negotiate a way out, or let's see what we can do. But then he went to the Cape Town Press Club 24 hours later, or 48 hours later, and told the rest of the country that he asked me to resign, which I thought was a little bit sad in a way, because we haven't had a proper conversation. And that was the last time he actually spoke to me. So I haven't seen him or spoken to him since, despite my best intentions. So I still, to this day, I still don't actually know what the reasons are, and they've never been offered to me in a real way.
He's never spoken to you since. So you'd been working for him for a month. You'd traveled abroad. You then arrive back on the Saturday. All is well. And on the Monday, you get fired. Well, you get asked to leave. And on the Wednesday, he goes public with it without perhaps giving you the indication of why. So he's the leader of the Democratic Alliance. And he has a ministry that he's running. Presumably, the one thing he can do is appoint his own people around him in that ministry. Or did he have to, should he have gone through the public sector, or should he have the public service organization, or should he have gone through the DA and asked them to appoint his chief of staff? What you must have, I mean, you've had a long time to think about this. What should he have done to not put you through the mill, as has occurred?
Well, having a conversation about it would have been appropriate, I find. And having negotiated exits, because I gave up everything for this job. On when he came to me and he headhunted me, I said, look, know who I am, right? I've got a bit of a reputation. I may have said silly things in the past. Like, just know that this will come back. There'll be a week or two of intense pressure, but have my back and I'll serve you to the best of my abilities. And you're perfectly fine with that. But I mean, as a minister, you are allowed to appoint whoever the hell you want. That's the essence of political appointments. And if the case is that he was receiving pressure from a political party who is not at all inherently involved in my life, I think that's a great danger and something that has to be investigated. If he felt pressurized or was instructed by his political party to get rid of me, or by his funders to get rid of me, that's a question that needs to be ventilated. And we need to really understand whether political interference in political appointments to the minister's office, because essentially I became a government employee. If a political party can determine the future of government employees, even though they are not a party to that employment contract, I think there's a lot of questions raised that need to be answered in due course.
Perhaps we can go a little deeper now, because I was quite shocked when I read Tony Leon's book, Being There, which was all about the negotiations. And he was right in the middle of it, negotiating on behalf of the DA. And it became quite apparent there that the relationship between the politicians and the media was intensely close. And what I mean by that is, if you read that book, you'll see almost every page, he says, well, then we informed, we updated our media contacts. And then he will write strange paragraphs. Oh, Adrian Basson is an extremely well-informed person, or this guy or that guy, or Peter de Toye, I think he referenced, and a few others. So you sit back and you think, hang on a minute, am I being sold a line here as a member of the public between the politicians, who then get the media to say things that they want the media to say? I always felt that maybe the Democratic Alliance, and in particular Steenhuisen, were immune from that kind of thing. But sure, what's happened in your case is, and what I read in Tony Leon's book, is making me look at it maybe differently. But I haven't been there, I haven't been inside it, and I certainly have not engaged with politicians to talk about a subject that they know I know a bit about, because it's where I'm from. You can perhaps give us some insights in that line of thinking.
I think it really depends who you are within the Democratic Alliance. I actually spoke to Ronaldo Hoss yesterday, and it was probably along the same lines. Media pressure led to the DA making decision to have him dismissed. The DA couldn't make a decision to have me dismissed because I don't work for the DA. They never have. So there was no doubt in my mind over the course of a six-week campaign. I was front page in the Sunday Times 4 out of 6 weeks, from the middle of August to the middle of September. That doesn't happen to anyone, certainly not to someone no, like sorry,
it
me.
Did,
I'm
it
a
did.
Podcaster.
It happened to Johan van Lochrenberg, remember, with the so-called SARS rogue unit. And that was front page of the Sunday Times week after week after week. It's almost like somebody, look, it's a different ownership of the Sunday Times now. So, but it was almost like there somebody was telling somebody in the newspaper, this is what you do. And so it's been well documented. In your case, might it be the same? Because you can't be, I mean, you're a good guy and you're a good looking guy and you're intelligent and you say interesting things, but I mean, you're not like that much that important, I would have thought, to have been on the front page of a newspaper 4 weeks in a row. It sounds strange.
That's what I thought as well. Like, no one knows.
Did they call you? Did they ever ask you?
Ministers.
Did they ask you for your side of the story?
Alec, they sort of did, but the questions were so ridiculous that I refused to answer. But also, I was told it's best not to do that. It's best not to answer. We'll just sustain throughout the sort of intense media campaign. And I truly believe it was a campaign by people. I'm not too sure who. I have various thoughts about who could be running this. I assumed quite a few members of the DA were unhappy because they want Johnston Hazen out as leader. I can assume people in the ANC could run it to see what they can use as a leverage point with their new GNU partner. If the DA blinks with this chief of staff, what else will the DA blink on? That would have been a good strategy to use. If I were the ANC, that's a strategy I would use as well. So maybe I was just a useful idiot for a lot of factions that don't know anything about me. But it would be interesting to find out who exactly is responsible. And yeah, I'll just leave it at that. I still don't know to this day. And most importantly, I wasn't given any reasons for why my tenure was untenable. To this day, I still don't actually know. But I am hoping to find out.
I wouldn't describe it as a useful idiot. I would describe it as collateral damage, surely. It seems to me that in this cesspool of political intrigue and infighting, and I mean, you don't know if it was within the DA, if it was the ANC, if it was just some malevolent actor outside, if it was a funder perhaps of the DA who said, hey, get rid of this guy. He's too controversial. You need to, who knows? But the fact that we don't know, I guess, is something that also raises quite a few flags. But getting back to that relationship between the media and politicians, and I'll call it legacy media because I don't think there's a similar, I don't have that relationship at all with any politician, but it's almost like a little pally-pally and you scratch my back, I scratch yours, etc. Did you see that?
Much more than I expected. Much more than I expected. In fact, quite a few, the minister himself, and if you had to say, no, I didn't pass on, like, you know, we know each other well, don't stress about him. And I'm like, I didn't pass on with absolute due respect is almost an operator for whoever he might work for. Like, I don't see him as a sort of independent media person. I mean, what things he's written about me, for example, are completely false. The things he's written about many other people are completely false. It's almost like he has an axe to grind or someone is telling him what to say in a particular manner. So I was a bit dismayed to hear these people the minister in particular, say that, no, Andrew Bison's a good guy. We get along very well. After that, I thought to myself, okay, like I'm actually in trouble here. Like I think he might take the side of the editor of News 24 who's actually writing all these things about me. And maybe he might believe him over the person over me, even though he spends a lot of time with me during that 6 week period when we worked intensely together. And I think that's also what tipped the scales over in that regard. It feels very strange when perhaps the media can be, the media wags the dog rather than the other way around in this particular scenario. So yeah, it's very pally and much more incestuous than I ever believed. And I think it's a symbiotic relationship of, it's useful for both people to actually be closer than what we might want them to be. It's not the fourth estate. It's maybe a PR firm for politicians.
Well, at the moment, but there is still a fourth estate and it's vibrant and it's strong. And you were part of it before you went in there. It's, and we see, I just see the growth in, if you like, non-traditional media now that you don't need a license to have a TV station, now that you don't need a government license to have a radio station. I've seen massive growth across the board in that area, because you can only fool some of the people some of the time. You can't fool them all the time. But from your perspective, since that period, my big question to you is, and I fight this battle all the time with lawyers, and you're a legally trained guy. There is the court of public opinion and there's the court of law. And the lawyers will always say, don't say anything because you're going to win it in the court of law. And my response to that is, you better say something in the court of public opinion, because if it takes you 3 or 4 years to win in the court of law, you're gone by that stage anyway. Your reputation's trashed. People think differently of you. Now that you've gone through the process that you have, should you not have combated all of this in the court of public opinion, i.e. in telling your story when I asked you to all those months ago, rather than staying stumm until, you know, the knife or the axe finally fell?
Yeah, it's something that I regret. So when you are in that position with that immense pressure, and the person who gave you the job is telling you just to don't worry about it, like, we'll sort it out, just don't talk to anyone yet, I thought they had my back, and that's probably very naive and romantic of me to believe even at that time. But at the time, I really thought, he came to me, he hit onto me, why wouldn't he have my best interests at heart? Looking back, you can see maybe it was a bit more conniving than that. And separately, you just, the questions, Alec, that I received, I mean, I would have gladly come onto your show any day, but the questions I received from journalists, from Sunday Times, I mean, the one question was, if the ministry has gay employees, how would you treat them? What was the answer?
What's that got to do with?
Yeah, I made an off-color joke about Freddie Mercury, right? And I laughed and I said, it's a complete joke. I love Queen. But of course, if you do something like that, you're literally, the joke is literally what you think. We live in this world where a stand-up comedian can go on stage, make a joke that he doesn't believe, but it's just funny. And people say, oh, that's what he truly believes. It's a crazy, a context doesn't matter to these people, to these so-called journalists. So, I mean, these are the questions I was receiving. And I was just disgusted by the glee with which people were sending me requests. And then I just said no, because I thought the principal had my back. Unfortunately, he did not after that. But looking back, as a first time being employed in a very long time and having a boss for the first time in a very long time, I should have actually taken a stand and actually had my say back then. But even then, if you do, it's all about, are you a homophobe? Are you a racist? These are silly questions to ask people. So anyway, back to your point. I would have gladly joined you a year ago, but I couldn't foretell the future. I thought I was backed up, but I didn't.
Yeah. So you're back, and we know that Media Storm's This Too Shall Pass is probably the best advice that anybody needs to look at, because they do. We have very short attention spans, particularly in the news cycle. So you would have imagined that was probably getting close to the end of the media storm, such as it was around you. And at some point in time, that would have been over, and then you would be judged on your delivery. And clearly, in the short period you were there, from what we've heard, you were delivering. But what happened after that? I mean, okay, so Steenhuisen didn't hold your back. He went out, threw you under the bus. He never spoke to you afterwards. He probably had other reasons for doing it within the DA, politics, funders, whatever. He never shared that with you. He never shared that with anybody. And I hope one day he does, because I will certainly ask him that. But what did you do after that? It's, you know, you're rocking up at the office every day, presumably. You're still being paid. You are now a public servant. You're taking taxpayers' money. You've got to at least feel, yeah, I'm very uncomfortable with this. How do I make a contribution? How do I earn the salary that I'm being paid by taxpayers?
So I did not leave because I was told through third parties and through the department that there's a process it's a process of exit. And I was waiting patiently for that process. I waited 3 months for the process to even start. I received zero indication or notification about anyone. I kept going to the office. I had to ensure that I wasn't there when the minister was there and sort of vice versa. Yeah, it's quite ridiculous. But I still had...
Whoa. Say that again. You went to the office, right. But if Steenhuisen was there, you weren't allowed to be at in the same time.
In the weeks preceding that, I wasn't allowed to hold meetings. I wasn't allowed to go on any trips. I wasn't allowed to do any public engagements. I wasn't allowed to... A lot of my work was stripped away from me, in essence. And I became a signing off stuff that I was responsible for as the chief of staff. Only I'm allowed to sign off on various things, and essentially for the last 3 months, that's all I did as chief of staff.
But you weren't allowed to go to the office if John was there, just in case you bumped into each other in urinals.
Apparently so, yes. Well, I was told by a third party that it's maybe best not to do it. This is a story for another day, but he already sort of replaced me with someone else who I believe is the interim chief of staff at the moment. And life went on for them, but no one ever spoke to me. So I still spoke to my team. I mean, I still had my secretary, the community officer. There's a team of 7 people that I still spoke to on a regular basis, on a daily basis, to ensure that they got what they needed. I've solved a few crises. The department used to call me and we need this, we need this, we need that. I try to organize as much as I could. So I was still doing work every single day. Obviously, I was just very limited in terms of what work I was allowed to do and not to do.
Yeah. Okay. It's pretty clear what happened. I don't think it leaves a heck of a lot to the imagination for those who want to just reflect on all of this. But where to from here? You're a very talented guy. You've built a business, a very public business in the past. Are you going to go back into that field? Are you going to go into law perhaps? Or do you just want to get out of the public spotlight now, given the experience you've had?
No, I have started a new YouTube channel called Undercurrents, which is performing rather well. It's, I do things when I feel like it on that particular channel. So I'm just going back into that. I really enjoy it. People really misunderstand. I'm not trying to save the world. I just really enjoy doing this. So I'm doing that at the moment. I have looked at, I do have a legal team assembled. So we have lodged a claim for unfair dismissal. It will be lodged very soon. And I'm looking at further legal action as well. For a variety of other things that I can't publicly state at the moment, but it will be in public quite soon once the legal team has given me the authority to do so. And while that is going on, I will look at my options elsewhere. But for now, I don't have any real plans. I'm spending time with my family, with my 3 children, with my wife, who I have been neglecting for the past few months. And after that, we'll see what arises or what new things I can build. But yeah, for now, I'm not exactly too sure. One day at a time.
Roman, you were fired on, is it the 3rd of June, your birthday? How old did you turn?
I'm 38 now.
You're 38. Why are you doing this? Why are you going to tie up your life for the next however many years in a legal fight? Why not just move on? What's motivating you outside of revenge?
No, I'm not vengeful at all. I just think I have been wronged. I think that people have treated me poorly. I think political parties have treated me poorly, even though I was not a member of their political party. And I think that people just can't keep getting away with unethical acts. And I think lessons need to be learned. Even if there is a settlement and a roundtable talk and debate about why things happened, I'll be very happy with that. But I'm not vengeful. I'm perfectly calm. I'm perfectly happy. But I don't think this is the way you should treat people. I don't think political parties should have any insights into how ministers appoint their staff or how they run their ministries. That's for the executive to take into account, not the political party. And at the end of the day, if you do call yourself a political party that separates yourself from the states, I think it's fair that you should actually do that. And if you don't do that, you should be punished for the hypocrisy and punished for the attempt to ruin people's lives with no due process or regard for their lives whatsoever. And ever since I've been terminated, quite a few people from a certain political party have been in contact with me and say that exactly the same thing has happened to them. So I think this sort of victimization of people who are not members of your party needs to stop. So I'll be looking at options going forward in that regard as well.
Do you think it's the party themselves or just big politics, like big companies, you have similar instances, big government, you have similar instances. There's always people who get nailed along the path. You know, it's a little bit like I can remember a very wise man saying to me once, people are not evil, but circumstances, especially if they're in big organizations, can make them evil because they think they're doing the right thing. Do you feel that there's a, you know, you guys try to disrupt and change politics in South Africa with the Purple Car, with the Capitalist Party of South Africa. Do you feel that is still something that is, in your case, has now been reflected?
So I fully agree that institutions matter more than people, especially if you work for an institution. And I fully agree that the culture of an institution determines the future of the people in that institution. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of ways to get what you want out of life without having to victimize or sacrifice people around you, especially though they don't belong to your institution. So we'll see what the options are in my particular case. It's worth testing them. It's worth probing. It's worth finding out exactly how this happened to me through no fault of my own. And I hope it doesn't happen to anyone else. If you want to have an outsized influence for what you want to achieve, then do it. But to have roadkill every time and say, oh, well, carry on driving, it's just not the way to do it, especially if you profess not to do that anyway as a political party. So pick a side. Do you want competent people from outside working towards your goal or not? That's for them to decide.
Liam Jacobs or Jacobs, what's your take on him? He's the, for those who don't know, he's a bright, young, rising star in the Democratic Alliance who has left the party and joined the Patriotic Alliance, who are their fierce rivals, particularly in the Western Cape province. His departure, he's not saying anything. Maybe he's a little bit like you, or trusting in somebody's got his back. I wish he would come into the court of public opinion and just tell us his story. But what would you think if there are any parallels whatsoever between you and he, or if there was anything that he might have learned from what happened with you?
I don't see many parallels, to be honest. I think the DA has spent a considerable time, if I may say, molding the politician, that is Liam Jacobs. But I also know Gaita McKenzie on three occasions. And Gaita McKenzie is the most charismatic, magnetic person I've ever met. After talking to him, you want to, you know, fight the world for his sake. He has that aura around him that is really, really powerful. And I think Liam is still fairly young. When I said processes don't matter, they should actually, maybe in this regard, matter a bit. But ultimately, that's his decision. And I don't know the man at all. So I can't really say anything, but I do think the DA spent a considerable amount of time molding the politician that he has become. And listen, if you are poached by someone else,
compliment.
A compliment. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. But I don't know. I'm so far removed from these political parties. I'm frankly disgusted by many of them. In fact, maybe all of them. So the horse trading is not really material to me, or matters to me, or to be honest. Yeah. Anyway, I'll just leave it at that.
It's another world, isn't it?
I've become very cynical about political parties. Not because I was naively romantic about it. If you want me to go, fine. Talk to me. Let's have a conversation. What can we negotiate? Okay, and then I'll go. But for me to make the ultimate sacrifice by joining, and then to make the sacrifice again by resigning to save the political career of the person who put me in that position, is just not fair. I've got a wife. I've got three children. I've got a bond. I've got a dog. Can't have everything for it. I you can't expect me just to leave. This is not, I don't know, this is not North Korea, right? This is, just talk to the person, make a deal, and exit. Simple as that, as it's done everywhere else in the world. But to ask that person to make the ultimate sacrifice for the second time in 2 months, and who's going to pay the bond? Who's going to look after my children? Who's going to? No, it's just not done. The 20 is just not done at all, and people need to pay for it.
You say second time in 2 months?
Well, the sacrifice was joining because I gave up everything before. I was living a grand life, making good money, living a grand life, running 3 businesses, director of the NGO, very happy. Got asked to become chief of staff. I sold, divested, and did everything I could, remove myself as directorship from all those entities, joined this. This will be my only source of income for 5 years. I will be working at a discount from what I was earning before. So that was a sacrifice, but it's something that I wanted to do and something that was offered. And the other sacrifice was, well, again, I just had to resign because of political pressure on the principal. You can't let other people take the responsibility. You deal with it, but it wasn't dealt with. Or you don't deal with it and you get punished later on. But I mean, that's essentially the equation at play that only the minister himself can answer. So yeah, those are the two sacrifices that I'm referring to.
And the vetting process between you being asked by John Steenhuisen to be his chief of staff to the actual appointment thereafter was the DA. We hear so much from Helen Ziller that the DA is very careful with the people who are in the party. You weren't in the party. You weren't a member of it. But was the government, because clearly this would have been quite an important post. You could have, well, you're going to meet the president of China. So it's you could meet anybody. Was that vetting process followed? Because my big question here, where I'm getting to, is at the end of the day, you were fired because you're a dual citizen or you were born in France. That's why. And did that never come up in this vetting? Was the vetting process so bad that they only discovered that at the end?
So the vetting process took about 6 weeks. I had to go do psychometric tests. I had to take an exam on the constitution and the law, and another exam, I believe, on how the government works, which thankfully I knew from my ILB. There was zero questions in any application within that process that asked if you're a dual citizen. They asked if you are a South African citizen, and they asked for your ID number, which I provided. And for the first 6 weeks of my employment, no one asked that question one bit. After I was off to resign, the question started arising. I actually received a letter from the department saying, we're looking into holding a disciplinary hearing because you didn't disclose that you were a dual citizen. And my response was, well, when did you ask me? You did not ask me. But now that you have asked me in this letter, I disclose it completely. If you've asked me, I would have disclosed it. And then the security vetting from the state security agency started. And that was also, there was a 6-hour interview, I believe, with the SSA, and a polygraph test with the SSA, which I did complete in record time, by the way. I know a lot of people in government hear about being vetted after a year or two or three, but I was vetted very quickly. They're very efficient, but they need to be. So it just does feel to me like once I was told to have a dignified exit and the process was playing out, it was contrived that this would be what would seal the deal for them in terms of terminating me. Because it was never a problem before that, but afterwards it became the main problem. And it's to this day, so I was terminated for having dual citizenship, but the contracts that are signed in terms of security clearance doesn't specifically say you need top secret security clearance, but that was the only one that was tested. So I hope that answered your question. Yes.
Where in France were you born?
I was born in Paris itself.
So it was Paris, not Paris. In other words, they couldn't have got that confused because there is a Paris in South Africa and they might, oh, but you actually thought Paris, but actually, no. So you're born in Paris, there can be very little confusion about, because that's on your passport and all the documentation, place of birth.
It's on my ID. In my CV that I gave them, it says born in Paris, France, speaks French fluently. In my application form, speaks French fluently. I mean, it was all there. If they asked me, are you a dual citizen? I would say, yes, of course, I'm a dual citizen. But if you don't ask, if I'm something, why would you volunteer something if they don't ask? That doesn't make any sense. If I go to have a face to get an ID and they say, okay, well, like, what blood type are you? Doesn't, and as you ask, you're not going to receive. So as soon as they asked, I did tell them. And then the whole contrived termination was started.
Roman, just to close off with, and it's a long time since I've had an hour's interview with someone, and certainly this one has flown by. So thank you for answering all the difficult questions and for sharing the way that you have. What should we learn, we the people, learn from your experience about those who govern us?
So here's the thing that really bothers me the most. I don't think I'm a genius or the best person in the world or someone with a terribly high IQ, but I do think that I'm rather effective at what I do. And for once, for the first time in many years, people from outside the political structures were asked to come in and join and help. And I think I would have done an adequate to competent job at it. But it seems like the system just doesn't allow that. You need to be molded by the parties themselves to actually get anywhere. And that's why there's a stasis in the GNU. It doesn't matter what you call it, the GNU or the ANC government. There's a stasis there because everyone there is part of the cult. And it's a cult of political parties, a cult of the ANC or the DA or whoever else. There's very little regard or very little capacity to have new, fresh people in there. And as I said, I don't think I would have, I'm not someone that can just rock the boat or change things overnight, but I do think there was a foundation where instead of going through the young leaderships programs or whatever the case might be, where these parties actually get new talents or the ANC Youth League, for example, these are just shadows of the existing political structure. There was an opportunity to get fresh new blood from outside the structures to actually get into the state to try and make it better for everyone. And I think that's the great betrayal for me. And I found that, it's a real shame. It's a real shame. I think we could have done a lot of very good things together. But politics gets in the way of the goal all the time. Happy. That's a lesson that people will learn.
I wonder what Javier Milei would think of your circumstance. He would probably, if I were to guess, say, Argentina, we had that. This is exactly what happened in Argentina for decades. Let's hope that it doesn't take decades before the penny finally drops here in this country. Roman Kabanak is the former chief of staff to the Minister of Agriculture, and I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.